House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Christopher Luxon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister, and it reads, does she stand by her statement that, quote, we have a responsibility to do our very best as a government through trying times to ensure that we are lifting the outcomes, quote, and, quote, this has been our focus the entire time we've been in office, quote?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, and whilst there is more to do, I remain very proud of what we have achieved across our time in office. On our COVID response, we have the lowest rate of COVID cases, hospitalisations and deaths in the OECD. On our economic response, we have record low unemployment and GDP up. Mr. Speaker, we have more than 175,000 people who have taken up our free apprenticeships and targeted trades training. And our apprenticeship boost subsidy has helped employees keep on more than 40,000 apprentices. We've made the largest increase to benefits in a generation and lifted incomes through our families package. Our income support changes since 2017 mean more than 100,000 families are, on average, $175 a week better off. Mr. Speaker, all 9 child poverty indicators have improved under Labor. And, Mr. Speaker, 66,500 children have been lifted out of poverty since our time in office. More than 200,000 children receive free, healthy lunches in schools. I could go on, but, Mr. Speaker, on this side of the House, I stand by our statement. We are focused on lifting the wellbeing and the economic wellbeing of New Zealanders, unlike that member who is focused on removing the top tax bracket for those on $180,000 or more.
Can she explain how the Te Huia train from Auckland to Hamilton, currently costing $280 for every passenger, is a good outcome for the $100 million of taxpayers' money spent on it to date?
Mr. Speaker, whereas in contrast to our investment in rail and in alternative transport options, I notice on that side of the House, in the words, I believe, of Matt Ducey, we want to make roads great again. Mr. Speaker, I notice as well that the member, when it comes to the challenge of climate change, wants to rely almost solely on the ETS. Now, if he were to do that, that could lead to $1.30 extra on petrol prices and, according to the Climate Commission, would mean that 1 in 10 farms would be converted to pine forests. If that member's sole goal when it comes to all focus on climate change is nothing but letting the ETS do the heavy lifting, I can tell you that he's going to have a hard time with rural New Zealand and every New Zealander who will feel it solely at the pump.
Did the $51 million spent on the cancelled bike bridge deliver a good outcome for taxpayers?
Mr. Speaker, again, this is where we have been focused on making sure that we are seeing mode shift in New Zealand. Now, again, Mr. Speaker.
Order.
And again, Mr. Speaker, here we have an opportunity to link up significant transport projects, including rail to the airport, with the third harbour crossing, which is, if I recall, the Members' Party used to support. That was part of the shift that we've made in our decision making. On this side of the House, we're willing to make bold infrastructure decisions. On that side, we see the continued delay.
Order.
And that is the reason we inherited such a lack of investment in New Zealand's infrastructure.
Excuse me.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she agree with the statement that one of the most important things we can do to address climate change is to build more roads, as asserted on breakfast television this morning by the Leader of the Opposition?
Mr. Speaker, I do share concern that the member has, that seems to be the only plan that the member across the aisle has. And, Mr. Speaker, I guess the issue that I have is that on the one hand, the National Party purports to support the zero carbon legislation and yet have voted against almost every single action that has been taken to make sure that we do that. And, Mr. Speaker, unless we invest in this transition, New Zealanders will bear the brunt of future energy shocks. New Zealand will bear the brunt of severe weather events. Primary producers will bear the brunt as exporters. This is not an option. We must move.
Is she aware the famed bike bridge was in fact cancelled despite us spending $51 million of taxpayers' money on it?
Mr Speaker, if I recall, the previous MP for Central Auckland, one Nikki Kay, was not the only person who supported the link across the harbour bridge, Mr Speaker. In fact, there were other National Party MPs who did as well. The fact is that, unfortunately, Mr Speaker, that proposal was no longer possible for structural reasons. When we, of course, heard of that information, we made sure that we had alternative investment plans so that we could continue the much-needed mode shift that Aucklanders are seeking.
Order, order. Before I take any more supplementary questions, the noise from my left is too loud. There are at least three members who I've had to call to order and have kept on interjecting after I've called them to order. And if that occurs again, I will regard it as grossly disorderly. Mr Lux.
The Honourable Michael Wood.
Thank you. Can the Prime Minister confirm that the Government has brought forward planning for an alternative Waitemata Harbour crossing from the 2040s with options to be consulted on later this year?
Mr Speaker, I can, and as I reflected in my earlier answer, this is part of an integrated approach to significant transport plans in Auckland. Auckland has suffered the consequences of a lack of investment in major infrastructure projects. We suffer the consequences and impacts on productivity. Previously, the National Party had been in favour of expediting the third harbour crossing. It is disappointing to hear that they are now panning those plans.
Why, despite job vacancies being at an all-time high, are 60,000 more Kiwis stuck on the JobSeeker benefit compared to when she took office? And is that an acceptable outcome when it's costing taxpayers $1.6 billion more every year?
Mr Speaker, of course, if you want to compare apples and apples, then you always look at the rate of people on a main benefit as a proportion of population. And in that regard, where we are is comparable to the time when the National Government was in office in the GFC. And many would argue the shock of COVID has been far greater than it was at that time. Mr Speaker, we are also seeing record departures from our main benefits as well. And that is because, unlike the National Party when they were in office, we have taken an active case management approach to support people into work. We have mana and mahi, we have the apprenticeship boost, we have he potama rangatahi, all programs to support those who may be on government support, particularly our young people, into work.
Can she explain how spending on education has increased by $6 billion a year, but there has been no improvement in literacy or numeracy outcomes for Kiwi kids?
Oh, Mr Speaker, and this is where I would again put to the member, you cannot have it both ways. The member thinks that there is no issue with inequity in this country, no issue with inequity, and yet education and health are areas where we time and time again see the impact of disparities in our society playing out in our education system and our outcomes. Yes, we have spent more because the last government didn't build new classrooms, didn't grow our teacher role, didn't make sure we were dealing with population growth. And what we are still catching up on is the fact that it was not enough focus on equity to improve outcomes across all of our population. Māori, Pacific, children with disabilities, and that is what we continue to repair.
Does she believe delivering just 1,300 out of a promised 100,000 Kiwi build homes after almost 5 years of trying is a good outcome for spending more than $1 billion of taxpayers' money?
Mr Speaker, National built 100 houses over 9 years. I will not be lectured by a party that instead of building public houses, sold them and pulled them down. Over 8,000 public housing places have been created under this government, more than any government since the 1970s. And still, we know there is more to do. That member's answer seems to be simply the RMA reform, and we're doing that too.
Does she accept that Kiwis struggling with the cost of living crisis have a right to be angry at her government's shocking record of spending more of their money but delivering worse outcomes?
Mr Speaker, in 2020, as a percentage of GDP, We spent less than National did in 2009. In 2021, we spent less as a percentage of GDP than National did in 2010. Mr. Speaker, we've taken on a similar amount of debt to respond to COVID-19 as National did in its first 5 years. If the member's so interested in outcomes, I am happy to have that debate toe-to-toe. We had children living in cars. We had a mental health crisis. We had an underinvestment and no investment in, Mr. Speaker, hospital infrastructure, classrooms, and all of the things that determine the outcomes for our children in this country. In 5 years, Mr. Speaker, we have turned around those stats, and we will continue to do so. But, Mr. Speaker, when we go from no investment to investment, I would happily debate outcomes on every single term.
Question number two, Barbara Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Mr. Speaker,
Honourable Grant Robertson.
Last week, Xero's Small Business Index bounced back in February as strong sales supported growth as firms grappled with the initial challenge of Omicron. The index was well above average at 114.5, largely driven by small business sales and wage growth. Sales surged 13.3% year on year, led by the construction and manufacturing sectors. Hospitality was the only sector to see a decline. Wages growth picked up pace to 4.3% compared to 3.8% in January, led by construction and hospitality. Job growth was 3.3%. Mr. Speaker, Xero said it was encouraging to see our small business community performing well over February, but noted that there are challenges, particularly for the hospitality sector, and that we needed to be doing everything we can to support those small businesses, as we have been doing.
Supplementary. What reports has he seen on the support available for businesses dealing with Omicron?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the government's targeted COVID support payment is helping viable but vulnerable businesses through Omicron. So far, a total of $956 million has been paid out under the three fortnightly COVID support payments to 193,233 applicants. Auckland has received 53% of the payments going by per business, followed by Christchurch on 9% and Wellington on 8%. By sector, the accommodation and hospitality sector received 16%, construction 14% and retail trade 8%. This is about providing cash flow and confidence and helping to protect jobs and support New Zealand businesses through this very difficult time.
Supplementary. What other reports has he seen on the economy?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the export sector is continuing to support the economy, with exports rising 22% to $5.5 billion in February. The main contribution once again came from dairy products, which rose 37% to $1.7 billion in the month, led by higher prices for milk powder and butter. Meat sector sales rose 21% to $981 million, while mechanical machinery and equipment rose 29% to $151 million. On an annual basis, exports were up 9.8%, Mr. Speaker, to $64.9 billion. Our exporters are contributing strongly to the economy, and I'm sure all members of this House would like to thank them for their work in such a volatile and uncertain environment.
Question number three, Nicola Willis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance and asks, does he agree with ANZ's view that, quote, concern about the domestic economic outlook is rising and is the top factor constraining investment by quite some way, end quote? And is he concerned that the cost of living is growing faster in New Zealand than in Australia?
Mr. Speaker, as I've said a number of times in the House, I acknowledge that 2022 is a challenging year for New Zealand businesses and households. Forecasts of economic growth this year have been pared back, but they do remain positive as New Zealand deals with Omicron, Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the ongoing disruption of the pandemic on global supply chains. As I mentioned yesterday to the member, we are in a strong position to be able to continue to support New Zealanders through this uncertainty. As to the second part of the question, there are a wide range of reasons for why inflation is at a particular level in a particular country, including at what stage of the pandemic each country is at. I would note that looking at the December quarter numbers, the two countries' inflation rates are not dissimilar, with New Zealand at 1.4% and Australia at 1.3%.
Supplementary question. Is he aware that inflation in New Zealand for the year ending December was 5.9%, while for the same period in Australia it was 3.5%, And has he seen a single forecast projecting New Zealand's inflation to be less in the coming year than it will be in Australia?
Speaker, in answer to the first part of the question, yes, I am aware of that. And I'm sure the member is also aware that inflation pressures are being felt all around the world. And we recently had the United Kingdom budget reflecting inflation projections of well over 7%. This is affecting people all over the world. It's the reason why this government has a focus on making sure those the most affected by price rises, those on low and middle incomes, are supported, rather than cutting the top tax rate so that those earning over $180,000 would get the benefit, as the member would prefer.
Supplementary. Does he agree with ASB that New Zealand's inflation outlook is, quote, worryingly high? And what steps, if any, is the government taking to support monetary policy to keep a lid on New Zealand's soaring levels of inflation?
Mr. Speaker, all New Zealanders will be concerned about rising prices, and it's the reason why we've taken the initiatives that we had. I'm glad that the member references monetary policy there, because that is indeed the role of the Reserve Bank, to be able to make sure that we have price stability. Alongside that, we will continue to operate a fiscal policy that is carefully balanced, making sure that we invest in the long term, making sure that we keep our debt levels under control, and making sure that all New Zealanders get a fair go. If the member wants to talk about things that might add to inflation, untargeted tax cuts that National is proposing that would benefit the highest income earners don't stand up very well.
Mentory, what is his explanation for rents rising faster than ever, up $50 a week in the past year alone? And is it seriously his position that international factors are to blame for this growth in a core component of New Zealanders' cost of living?
Mr. Speaker, I'll give the member this. That's not all about international factors. That's about the fact that the National Party oversaw the sell-off of state houses and managed to build 100 affordable houses over 9 years. It's about supply. Houses don't get built right away. On this side of the House, we're now building houses at a faster rate than any government since the 1970s, trying to make up for the members' party's mistakes.
Supplementary. Is it now the position of New Zealand's Minister of Finance that the reason our country has experienced record growth in rental costs is because 5 years ago some state houses were transferred from ownership by the Crown to ownership by community housing organisations?
Well, actually, Mr Speaker, that not very clever explanation doesn't wash, Mr Speaker. The National Party needs to own its record. They sold off state houses in the middle of a housing crisis, Mr Speaker.
Supplementary. Why does he keep blaming COVID for New Zealand's poor economic performance when, despite Australia currently experiencing a surge in cases, consumer confidence surveys show Australians feel far more confident about their economic prospects than New Zealanders do?
Mr Speaker, the member might like to talk the New Zealand economy down, but I invite her to read the IMF's report, where they congratulated New Zealand not just on the way that we've dealt with COVID from a health perspective, but also from an economic perspective. We have 3.2% unemployment in New Zealand at the moment. We have debt levels that are lower than the countries we choose to compare ourselves with. We have a thriving export sector, and we have good prospects for New Zealand. New Zealand's economy is in good shape to get through COVID-19.
Supplementary. Why does the minister keep congratulating himself for his economic approach of more taxes, more regulation, and more poorly executed spending, when the cost of living is soaring and New Zealanders' confidence is collapsing?
Mr. Speaker, the IMF congratulated New Zealand for its economic performance. That is a result of the hard work of businesses and of households right across New Zealand. New Zealanders can be extremely proud of what they have managed through COVID-19. Now we're in a strong position to be able to recover and rebuild from there.
Right on, Prime Minister.
Supplementary to the Minister, can the Minister confirm reports that during January of this year, Australia's consumer confidence plunged to levels not seen since 1992, as a result of a wave of Omicron, similar, of course, to the experience New Zealand is having, which we too will recover from.
Mr Speaker, yes, and as I said in my primary answer, an impact on the economy is often comparable to where we are in the pandemic cycle. New Zealand is in the peak of our Omicron outbreak, but we are extremely well positioned to be able to come out of this. What, however, would not help us is untargeted tax cuts that the National Party is proposing for people earning over $180,000 a year, or for that matter, increasing expenditure on everything from...
A point of order, the Honourable Mr Brown.
Mr Speaker, I seek leave for a snap debate forthwith so that the Deputy Prime Minister, who has relied on his attacks on the National Party over the last week and a half, can better explain his position and can
order.
Be responded
will
to.
The member resume his seat. The member knows that he may not interrupt an answer for that sort of approach. I suggest that if a member wants to seek leave for such a debate, he could do one at the end of question time, and it might well be granted.
There's a general debate.
I think. The Minister was rudely interrupted, and I'm going to let him start again.
Oh, very good, Mr Speaker. Yes, as I said in my primary answer earlier on, Australia and New Zealand are experiencing the pandemic at different times. In New Zealand's case, we are in the middle of Omicron and it is having a major impact on us. What we do know, though, is that we are in a strong position to recover from that. We also know that the kind of approach being favoured by the National Party of tax cuts to those who earn more than $180,000, while at the same time claiming that they're going to be increasing expenditure on health and defence and housing simply doesn't add up.
Question number four, Irina Williams.
To the Minister of Energy and Resources, what recent announcements has the government made on renewable energy for Māori and public housing?
The Honourable Dr Megan Wood.
Mr Speaker, 180 families living in Māori and public homes are set to benefit from locally generated clean, cheap power as a result of government funding for small-scale renewable energy trials. This includes 12 projects to develop renewable products, which will also help to bring energy independence to remote communities. This program is in addition to other government action to support people with their energy costs, including the winter energy payment, warmer Kiwi homes, and cutting petrol excise by 25 cents per litre.
What are some examples of projects previously funded by the Māori Housing Renewable Energy Fund?
Mr Speaker, one example is Te Arawa Whana Ora, who installed solar panels on 14 homes around Rotorua last year. Over summer, those households saved on average about $100 on their monthly power bills, a reduction of between 30 and 50%. These projects also support broader energy benefits, such as supporting Māori energy businesses, building skills and enabling mana whenua to return to traditional energy sources.
What else is the government doing to increase the uptake of renewable energy for public housing?
Mr Speaker, Kāinga Ora is currently trialling solar panels on 100 public homes in Lower Hutt and Porirua. These are expected to be installed by October. Kāinga Ora is planning further solar installations throughout the country. By 2024, approximately 1,000 public homes will be fitted with renewable energy systems. 400 properties are already committed to across Whangarei, Christchurch, Nelson, Napier and Auckland.
The Honourable Chris Bishop.
What steps, if any, has the Minister taken to make sure that any public announcements around Kāinga Ora comply with public sector neutrality, particularly concerning Labour Party MPs and candidates?
Mr Speaker, I'm sure the Minister of Energy and Resources would be happy to talk to the Minister of Housing, but these steps have been well traversed by the Minister of Housing in this House, including conversations...
I shouldn't have allowed the question. No. I apologise.
You need to get a primary.
Is there a further supplementary? Question number five, David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr Speaker.
Mr Goldsmith, be quiet.
Point of order. Mr Speaker, I wonder if you'd consider awarding the ACT Party an extra sup for that interruption.
I will consider it.
Thank you. Your consideration's appreciated. Mr Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Finance and reads as follows. What was core Crown tax revenue forecast to be for the financial year to June 2021 in the 2020 pre-election economic and fiscal update, and how much tax revenue was actually collected for that year?
Mr. Speaker, as the 2020 pre-election economic and fiscal update outlines in its very first paragraph, it was set against the backdrop of continued uncertainty about New Zealand's economic outlook due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The Treasury in the PREFU warned the effects of COVID-19 on the economy were expected to be more persistent than before, and as such had lowered its nominal GDP forecasts compared to Budget 2020. PREFU included a forecast for core Crown tax revenue in the year to June 2021 of $84.660 billion, or 28% of nominal GDP, which was forecast at the PREFU to be $302.9 billion at 30 June 2021. PREFU also forecast net debt to be 43% of GDP at 30 June 2021, or $130.2 billion in nominal terms. I have good news for the member. New Zealand's economy was stronger in the June year, 2021 year, than forecast in the PREFU. Nominal GDP was reported at $339.7 billion for the year to June 2021. As a result of the stronger economy, which led to higher business profits, more people in work and higher wages, tax revenue in the year to June 2021 was $98 billion, or 28.8% of GDP. This also meant lower net debt at 30.1% of GDP, that's $102 billion, versus the $130 billion forecast at PREFU.
But before the member asks the supplementary, I have given consideration to his request. I will grant it by transferring one question from the National Party to ACT. Supplementary question, oh. David Seaman.
Squid game.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
A point of order, Chris Bishop.
Can I ask why you have decided to take one supplementary off National and give it to the ACT Party? Mr. Goldsmith, I think, basically laughed momentarily at the start of a question. Yeah. That is not out of order.
Well, I was actually considering whether it should be one or two, and I decided to be lenient.
David Seymour. So, did the minister's answer mean he expected $84 billion and he got $98 billion, meaning he ended up with $14 billion more tax than he had expected?
Well, Mr. Speaker, that's the Treasury's forecasts in the pre-election fiscal update. And so, yes, there were $14 billion more, as I noted in the primary answer. It was a reasonably volatile and uncertain time in the global economy.
What happened to the extra $14 billion of tax he didn't expect to collect? Or does he just not trust Treasury's forecast?
No, Mr. Speaker, a number of things happened, but one of the main outcomes was lower net debt, Mr. Speaker, as I noted in my primary answer.
How is it possible that the government can suddenly find itself with an additional $14 billion and not be able to afford a single cent to cut income taxes for households that are being squeezed from every direction and do not benefit from the various benefit increases and other transfers the government seems so obsessed with?
Mr. Speaker, we've traversed this ground a number of times in the House. There are many different priorities that fall on the government, particularly in the period that we're covering through the member's question, as we dealt with the end of the Delta outbreak, as we dealt with further COVID costs, and as we invested, as we need to do, in long-term issues like health and education and in housing.
Supplementary. Is not the real reason for the government's tax windfall that inflation also took off beyond the Treasury's forecast, being 3.3% in the year to last June instead of the 1.2% that was forecast, pushing up the price of everything, with the government profiting $14 billion from the cost of living crisis?
Mr. Speaker, no doubt inflation has been a factor in this. I would also note that the government, not only when there's an inflationary environment, takes more money in, we have many more outgoings as well as a result of inflation increasing. While the member's on that topic, though, I do note that the PREFU forecast wage growth of 0.9%, but it turned out to be 4%, so wages grew during that period.
Does the minister accept that inflation is giving more and more taxes to the government, but the government is not prepared to give anything back by letting New Zealanders keep more of their own money when they're squeezed from every direction?
Well, Mr Speaker, as again we've covered in this House, we recognise the significant impact of the cost of living increases on New Zealanders, and it's the reason why we have had a package on 1 April that has seen a significant lift in the incomes of low and middle income New Zealanders.
Supplementary. If the government gets another happy surprise for itself of greater tax revenue than forecast in this financial year, might it finally be able to let those hard-working families squeeze from every direction keep just a little bit more of the money that they earn?
Mr Speaker, obviously I will never preempt future budget decisions, let alone one using the members' dates that would be in Budget 2023. What I can say is that on this side of the House we'll continue to focus on a balanced approach. That means, yes, we try to keep debt low. That means, yes, we try to make sure that we're investing in the long-term things that New Zealanders need. Those New Zealanders he's referring to deserve a health system that means that they get good quality health care wherever they are in New Zealand. They deserve for their children to be in classrooms that are warm and dry. They deserve to know that there will be good public transport and roading networks right across New Zealand. Those things don't come for free either.
Commentary. How can the Minister explain the massive growth in tax revenue and his refusal to cut taxes by talking about health and education when on the same figures total health and education expenditure was actually less than forecast?
Well, Mr Speaker, I do think it's important that the member remembers that if we look at the most up-to-date forecast with the HAIFU, Core Crown tax revenue is going to stay below 30% of GDP across the forecast period. That has been a steady level of the Core Crown tax revenue will be below 30% of GDP across the forecast period. That is around about where it has been for a number of years. On this side of the House, Mr Speaker, I think we understand that there has to be a balance when you put a budget together. Just saying that you're going to spend more but cut taxes and reduce debt does not add up, and that is the problem for the opposition at the moment.
Question number 6, Chloe Swarbrick.
To the Minister of Conservation. Does she stand by her statement yesterday that, quote, the Department of Conservation has advised me that there are currently no burrows with any signs of korora in the rock wall at Putiki Bay, end quote? If so, what does she say to the Protect Putiki group who documented footage of korora at Putiki Bay last night?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Kuratapu Allen.
I thank the member for her question and ongoing advocacy for the community at Te Ākau o Putiki. As the member will be aware, I take responsibilities as the Conservation Minister, including the protection of our taonga species, incredibly seriously, which has led to the work we're doing to review the Wildlife Act, the partial review of the conservation law, and centering the Aotearoa New Zealand biodiversity strategy at the heart of conservation here in Aotearoa. With respect to the footage reference, yes, I can confirm that I have seen that footage and consequently made further inquiries today to my officials, expressing my dissatisfaction that the context that the information in which it sit was not provided to me in a way that I consider was fulsome or adequate. While I stand by the statement I made yesterday in the context of which it was made, it's become clear to me that the information was inaccurate, including that korora have sometimes been returning to those burrows in the evening. And further, I can confirm to the member that on subsequent inquiries made today, I have been advised that since the authority was granted under the Wildlife Act, no korora have to date been identified at the site during the period of works, but in the event that they are, can be relocated in alignment with the authority granted underneath the Wildlife Act.
Supplementary. When granting a permit to move korora, what assessment, if any, did the Department of Conservation make of the advice of Professor John Cochrane that his conservative estimate is at least 60 korora live in the full rock wall?
I'm advised that the Department of Conservation and primarily the ecologists worked closely with Dr Cochrane and leaned into the advice of many of the community groups there on Waiheke Island, including Protect Putiki, various bird rescue groups and the like. My understanding from the information that the department has provided to me is, first, that many of the references to the information provided were with respect to a broader, the broader consents that have been granted by the Auckland Council with respect to the broader marina development. With the specific reference to the just the application under the Wildlife Act, I've been advised that on balance, whilst the birds, the korora, live in that rock wall and do return to that area sometimes in the evenings, that during the daytimes and during the period which the works will be undertaken, there is very low risk, that low chance, as I best understand, that those korora will be on site. However, when granting the permit, those are at the forefront of the Department of Conservation's considerations. It left with two options. One, relocate those korora in the event that they're found, or two, leave them there and let the works occur around them. On balance, the Department of Conservation made the determination that to grant the authority under the Wildlife Act was the best in the circumstances for the preservation of the korora.
Supplementary. Has the Department of Conservation conducted any on-site monitoring for the removal of the rock wall while it has gone ahead this week? If not, why not?
I understand. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I understand from my inquiries made this morning that they have made observations with respect to the monitoring in building up to the granting of the permit. However, I have expressed very clearly my expectation as the Minister for Conservation that the department take an active role and be physically present to monitor the works whilst they're being undertaken when that work is ongoing through the period of the permit that left to run.
Supplementary, what can members of the public do if they find evidence of korora in distress at Putiki Bay at the site of construction?
That's a great question from the member. There's a couple of things that can be done. Of course, when any member of the public does see any taonga species in any form of distress, they can ring the Department of Conservation, 0800 Doc Hot, and they will be put through to people that would advise them on the best next steps. I can assure also the member that a number of inquiries have been put through to the Department of Conservation over the past year with respect to the Putiki area, and the department have advised me that they've acted swiftly to respond to those inquiries.
Supplementary, does the Minister agree that the law as it stands is failing to protect these korora? And if so, what advocacy has she undertaken for improving protection of native species such as korora in consultation with the Minister for the Environment in the proposed new Natural and Built Environments Bill?
Mr. Speaker, I agree with the member that the conservation law that governs some of our taonga species across the board I consider is inadequate. It's outdated and it needs some fundamental reform. That, of course, needs to be done in partnership with communities at place, and it will take some time. We have undertaken work since I've taken office, working in collaboration with a number of NGOs to do the fundamental first review work that needs to be done of the conservation law environment. With respect to the natural and built environments and the RM reforms more generally, my colleague, the Minister Parker, and myself are ardent advocates for biodiversity and will ensure that that's a key linchpin and the reforms ahead.
Point of order.
A point of order, Chloe Ford.
Table, these images of korora from Phil Stebbing taken in August 2021 at Putiki Bay. They are, of course, of korora at Putiki Bay.
Is there any objection to that photograph, that image being tabled? There appears to be none. Question number 7, Dr. Liz Craig.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for COVID-19 response and asks, what recent changes have been made to vaccination requirements in New Zealand?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. From tomorrow, young people aged 16 and 17 will be able to receive a free booster dose of the Pfizer vaccine at least 6 months after completing their primary course. They'll be able to do so by visiting any walk-in vaccination clinic around the country.
A booster dose is particularly recommended for 16 and 17-year-olds who are at higher risk of severe COVID-19 symptoms and hospitalisation, and that includes those who are immunocompromised or who are living with a family member who are immunocompromised, and our Māori and Pacific rangatahi.
Supplementary. How many rangatahi will now be eligible for this booster, and what assurance has he had on the safety of this decision?
Mr Speaker, I can advise that 36,000 rangatahi between age 16 and 17 years old will be eligible to receive a booster dose. MedSafe follows a very robust approvals process to ensure that all vaccines we use here in New Zealand meet acceptable standards for safety, quality and efficacy. We know that immunity to the virus does wane over time, so getting a booster is the best protection someone can have against COVID-19. And it's also a reminder to any New Zealander who hasn't yet had their booster that even if they've already had COVID-19, getting a booster at least 3 months after they've tested positive for COVID-19 can help to reduce the risk of being reinfected and passing it on to others. It also reduces the chances of becoming very ill and ending up in hospital.
Supplementary. What other recent changes have been made to vaccination requirements in New Zealand?
Mr Speaker, from Monday, New Zealanders no longer have to use a vaccine pass or a My Vaccine Pass. While vaccine passes have been extremely useful in helping us to get to high rates of vaccination, and they were particularly useful in our fight against Delta, with around 95% of our eligible population now at least double vaccinated, we don't need that tool any longer. Businesses that want to continue to use My Vaccine Pass, however, will be able to continue to do so, but they'll need to have a justification for doing that, taking into account the latest public health advice.
Supplementary. What will these changes mean for government mandates, and what should employers do if these mandates no longer apply to them?
Mr Speaker, government vaccine mandates for all sectors except for health and care workers, prison workers and border workers have been removed. They remain for health and care workers and prison staff because they come into contact with a lot of people who are at high risk of serious illness from COVID-19. And, of course, our border workers, because they are the first people who'd be likely to be exposed to any new variants of concern that emerge internationally. Employers who have had a government mandate applying to their workforce should undertake or update a work health and safety risk assessment, reflecting updated public health advice to determine what controls are appropriate for their workplaces.
Question number 8, Erica Stanford.
To the Minister of Immigration, does he stand by his statements and actions?
The Honourable Chris Farfoy.
Mr Speaker, yes. In particular, I stand by the Government's plan to reconnect with the world. Over the last 2 years, New Zealanders have relied on our Government to take a careful approach to the border, and this caution has paid off, with lives and livelihoods protected on a scale not seen elsewhere in the developed world. We are now taking a staged and balanced approach, which will see New Zealand open up fully throughout the course of 2022. We've already welcomed back highly skilled workers and working holiday makers, and next week we'll also welcome back people offshore with a valid work or student visa, up to 5,000 students to study in semester two, and also we'll welcome back our Australian brothers and sisters.
Supplementary question, Mr Speaker. Why has he not changed the criteria of the 2021 residency visa so that all migrant nurses are eligible, regardless of their visa type, to help fill the shortfall of the 4,000 nurses as identified by the Minister of Health on Sunday?
Mr Speaker, the criteria of the 2021 resident visa was very much focused on making sure we could secure the workforce that have been here and contributing over the last 2 years. The primary purpose of people's visas had to be work, and we have given certainty to a number of people who have already applied and been given residency, but importantly also given their employers a certainty about retaining their staff.
Supplementary question, Mr Speaker. In light of that answer, then what does he say to GP Paul Jones and his anaesthetist wife, Fleur Harding, working in New Zealand, who recently left New Zealand because they were on the wrong visa type to be eligible for the 2021 residence visa, and why won't he change the criteria to include all doctors?
Mr Speaker, again, the bedrock, part of the bedrock criteria for being eligible for the 2021 resident visa was being on the appropriate work visa. If people were here on the likes of a working holiday visa and acting as a locum, their primary purpose was being here to work and have a holiday, not to work in New Zealand.
A point of order, Chris Bishop.
For two supplementary questions in a row, the Minister's been asked around why criteria haven't been changed by my colleague Erica Stanford. In both answers, I'll let the first one go, but both answers, the Minister didn't get anywhere near addressing the actual question that my colleague asked.
Well, I actually thought that, I can't focus two supplementaries back, but the last one answered the question absolutely. He very clear. Erica Stanford.
Supplementary question, Mr. Speaker. Is he concerned, based on numbers from the immigration website, that the 2021 resident visa is on track to grant an extra 40,000 to 60,000 migrants residency above the 165 approved by Cabinet, yet still manages to miss out the doctors and nurses that we desperately need?
Mr. Speaker, I'm not concerned about making sure that we give more people certainty who have made a commitment to New Zealand, especially over the last 2 years, to make sure that they can be in work. The criteria are clear. And the people who are eligible have to have primarily been here on a work visa that was focused on work.
Must just start. Question number 9, Rachel Brocken.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for the Environment. How is the government improving the planning system to build more houses and infrastructure?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable David Parker.
Excuse me. The government has removed barriers within our planning system, enabling the building of more houses and infrastructure. Since 2017, the number of houses consented annually in Auckland has doubled from 10,000 to over 20,000, with townhouses and flats increasing fivefold from 2,000 to 10,000 per annum. This government has ensured that our major cities must enable further intensification in their plans by August 2022. Under the new rules, homes up to three homes, three stories high, can be built on most sites without the need for a resource consent, and I acknowledge the support of the National Green and Maori parties for this significant change to planning laws. We're far from done. We plan to introduce legislation this year that will repeal and replace the RMA.
Very good.
What reports has he received about the inadequacy of New Zealand's planning system?
Mr. Speaker, I'm sure that many members will have read with interest the report that came from the Infrastructure Commission this week, which found that New Zealand's, quote, prohibitively expensive housing market could have been prevented by congestion mitigation policies and less restrictive planning rules. The Commission says that when urban planning policies limit development up in the centre of the city or out at the fringes, it leads to both reduced housing supply and higher housing prices. They also note that unless the planning system is very specific about prioritising housing and infrastructure as core objectives, amenity concerns about urban and natural character will prevail over building the homes that New Zealanders need. The Commission is correct, and prioritising a massive increase in housing infrastructure is a focus of the planning system reforms.
How will the repeal and replacement of the RMA enable more houses and infrastructure?
Mr. Speaker, the RMA takes too long, costs too much, and hasn't protected the environment. It has imposed significant costs on both the natural environment and developers by often leaving individual consenting decisions to resolve higher-level planning issues, enabling NIMBYism to strangle housing. The reform will create more certainty about what development will be permitted to take place, reducing costs and delays for developers and other participants, and further increasing housing supply.
Question number 10, Dr. James McDowell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Defence. Does he stand by his statement that, quote, we've already put towards Cabinet a number of options which include some lethal support, end quote? If so, what lethal support was included?
The Honourable Penny Hanara.
Mr. Speaker, yes. Cabinet continues to look at the most significant contributions New Zealand can offer that will make a material difference to Ukraine. Our support to date has been comprehensive. It includes military intelligence, economic sanctions, trade tariffs on Russian goods, humanitarian aid, providing visas for family members to shelter in New Zealand, through to support for criminal investigation in the International Criminal Court. We have always said we will continue to consider what more we can do and that nothing is off the table given the unprecedented nature of this invasion by Russia.
There's a very clear question, which had two parts. The Minister's addressed the first part, but he hasn't addressed the second.
Mr Speaker, as the Minister of Defence, my job is to inquire of the Defence what best support mechanisms we can offer to Ukraine. Ultimately, Cabinet makes that decision, and Cabinet has made a decision and will continue to assess the situation to make sure that we can respond accordingly.
A point of order, David Seymour.
Mr Speaker, he's made a statement publicly saying that he took a range of possible supports to Cabinet. He's been asked on notice in the House what those other supports included. Surely he's required to answer that question and tell us what they were.
He is either required to address that question, which he hasn't done yet, or to indicate that it's not in the public interest to do so. And quite often in the defence area, you do get to that area. But I would have thought people who read the news might know the answer.
Then, sir, it isn't in the best interest of the public to know that.
Entry. Does he support Cabinet's refusal to send any of our Javelin anti-tank missile systems to help defend Ukraine from the atrocities being committed against them by the Russian Federation?
Mr Speaker, we haven't made a decision specifically on that, and I will reiterate the point that Cabinet will continue to make the appropriate decisions which are in line with the needs of Ukraine.
Supplementary. Will the Minister take his proposal to supply lethal aid back to Cabinet for reconsideration in light of new revelations and mounting evidence of Russian war crimes against Ukrainian civilians, including children?
Mr Speaker, my job is to always present options to Cabinet for consideration, and I will reiterate the point that we as a government stand against the actions of Russia at this point in time and have supported the call for a war tribunal to make sure that for those atrocities people are held to account.
If the Minister won't commit to taking back the proposal or presenting a new one to Cabinet, does he no longer stand by his decision to do so in the first place?
That's not what I said, Mr Speaker.
Yeah, I probably should have ruled the question out because it wasn't what he said. Further supplementary?
How bad does the situation in Ukraine have to get for the Minister to convince his colleagues that providing lethal support is the right thing to do?
Mr Speaker, I reiterate the point that Cabinet considers a large number of options, and we've already moved very swiftly on quite a number of those. And I want to also echo the sentiments from our partners offshore, the UK in particular, who commends New Zealand for the actions and the swift action we have taken to date. They have committed to us working together to make sure that our response is in line with the need of Ukraine.
Question number 11, the Honourable Mark Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Police. Does she stand by her statement? I reject the premise that gang tensions have increased under this government's watch. If so, how does she reconcile that with reported police intelligence, which states parts of the country have experienced unprecedented levels of gang violence in the past year?
Honourable Paul Williams.
Mr Speaker, I stand by the full context of all my answers at question time. In answer to the member's second question, gangs have been a feature of New Zealand society for well over half a century. What police intelligence shows us is that the arrival of 501s in 2015 has fundamentally changed the nature of gangs, making them much more overt and sophisticated. This government has no tolerance for gang violence, and that is why we will continue to support police in their work to crack down on gangs by deploying 700 more organised crime staff and passing legislation to give them more tools to address gang violence.
Supplementary. Does she agree with Auckland Labor List MP Helen White, who wrote an article claiming gang activity...
Order. Who was that? No, someone...
It was up the back there, Mr. Speaker. Okay.
Which member interjected?
I'll withdraw and apologise.
A point of order, Mr. Bishop.
Last time you took one off the Act Party, could we have that one back, please?
Well, the trouble is that they're finished for the day. Have they got any left tomorrow? All right, well, the Act Party lose one of its three questions tomorrow. The National...
speak in favour of Chris Bishop's earlier point of order that you shouldn't remove a question for such a trivial interruption.
Some people say that consistency is the last refuge of fools, but I'll stay consistent with this one. Mark Mitchell, you have you now have an extra supplementary, which I think gets you to
four. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does she agree with Auckland Labor List MP Helen White, who wrote an article claiming gang activity had increased in Auckland, when just 2 days before the article was published, she told the House she rejected the premise that gang tensions had increased under this government's watch?
Mr. Speaker, I have said consistently this government is concerned about crime, and that's why we've boosted police funding by $450 million and deployed an additional 300 organised crime staff. Ms. White acknowledges the impacts of COVID-19 that has had on Auckland, and that's why the government has provided a range of supports to those affected. It's also why we've put an additional 360 police on the beat in Auckland since we came to government and set up the retail crime unit.
Supplementary. Is it correct that from January 2021, only 13 net new organised crime staff have been recruited?
Mr. Speaker, what is correct is our commitment to ensuring we have sufficient cops on the beat and they have sufficient resources in terms of funding and equipment and legislative tools. We are well on the way to meeting our targets for 1,800 new police, 700 being deployed into organised crime.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order.
Mr. Speaker, I can't really... I don't think I could get that question any more tighter. It was very specific.
And the member knows that if he asks a general first question, he can't expect the minister to answer a specific supplementary. Just mentioning gangs is not enough to expect the minister to come prepared with a detailed response to a very specific question. Mark Mitchell.
Yeah, right.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Why, under her watch, are gangs regularly taking over public spaces and roads, abusing and putting members of the public at risk?
Mr. Speaker, there's no doubt that gangs are a feature, a harmful feature of our communities, and that's why this government is committed to giving police the tools to crack down on gangs and gang crime, funding 700 more organised crime staff, deploying the tactical response units, and that's why we've introduced legislation to give police more tools.
Stop your scaremongering.
Does the member want to use the final supplementary?
Mr. Speaker.
No obligation.
Have 501s increased gang tension in New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker, let's not forget that Australia's exporting of this gang problem to New Zealand began under National in 2015. And they responded by cutting the number of cops on the beat, and we are playing catch-up. I agree with Christopher Luxon that 501s are changing the nature of gangs in New Zealand, and that is why we are funding the largest ever increase in organised crime staff, tightening up our gun laws and increasing the police budget by more than 30%.
Camilla Bellich.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Number 12.
Thank you. To the Minister of Workplace Relations and Safety, how will fair pay agreements improve outcomes for those on lower incomes?
The Honourable Michael Ward.
Mr. Speaker, in yesterday's first reading of the Fair Pay Agreements Bill, we heard stories of frontline workers in some of our lowest paid jobs, cleaners, security guards, supermarket workers and cleaners. The contribution of Kiwis performing some of the most essential work in our country has been systematically undervalued for too long. The Fair Pay Agreements Bill is about setting minimum pay and conditions for these types of work to improve outcomes for those on lower outcomes and in turn create fairer, safer and more productive workplaces. Combined with other government policies such as increases to the minimum wage, which have increased the wages of a minimum wage worker by $218 per week since 2017, this shows the government's commitment to supporting New Zealanders on low to middle incomes, boosting wages and productivity.
Supplementary. How do fair pay agreements encourage higher productivity?
Mr Speaker, the Fair Pay Agreements Working Group, chaired by the Right Honourable Jim Bolger, identified that sector-based bargaining provides the opportunity for employers to invest and engage without the fear of being undercut by other employers engaged in a race to the bottom on wages. The Working Group considered that there may be mutual benefits for workers and employers through increased worker engagement, increased productivity and better workplaces. It doesn't take a giant leap, Mr Speaker, to recognise that a more engaged workforce that values their work and is compensated fairly is likely to be more motivated and productive. We see a good example in Australia, where with sector-based bargaining there for the past 40 years, they have a rate of labour productivity far higher than New Zealand does currently.
Will fair pay agreements result in compulsory unionism and strike action by workers?
Mr Speaker, categorically no. The bill is explicit in its requirements that unionism remains voluntary and that the benefits of fair pay agreements apply to members of unions and people who are not members of unions. It also explicitly prevents recourse to industrial action either by employers or employees. Any information to the contrary is categorically false. And while I expect there to be vigorous debate around this issue, I encourage anyone engaged in the debate to do so on the merit and substance of the bill, to deal with the problems of low wages in New Zealand that we are trying to resolve, and not to engage in misinformation.
That concludes oral questions.